The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Inequality has increased beyond all recognition since the 1970s. Does it matter? And if so, how should politicians respond? Are those at the top of the income distribution the brightest and the best, or simply the luckiest? And was the Pope right to tweet this week that inequality is the root of social evil? And why has an obscure French economist suddenly shot to the top of the book charts? Also today, the extraordinary arrest of Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams. I'll be discussing the political fallout with our Ireland correspondent, Henry MacDonald. But first, let's get stuck into the inequality question with our expert panel, the Guardian columnist, Polly Toynbee, the political writer and economist, Andrew Lillico, and the epidemiologist and author of The Spirit Level, Richard Wilkinson. A warm welcome to you all. It's an old idea that two nations between whom there's no intercourse or sympathy, who are as ignorant of each other's habits, thoughts and feelings as if they were dwellers in different zones, inhabitants on different planets, the rich and the poor. Those words from Benjamin Disraeli in the mid-19th century. 160 years later, and the French economist Thomas Piketty has come up with an explanation. It's all because the rate of return on existing wealth is usually greater than the rate of growth in the economy as a whole, which means that the rich get richer a lot faster than everybody else. Now, Piketty's been in London this week, and I caught up with him and asked him why his book has taken off in the way that it has.
I could see, of course, in the US that rising top managerial compensation pretty much everywhere in the US, except in the growth statistics, which is, you know, the GDP growth performance has been quite mediocre over the past few decades. So if you have, you know, a huge part of that mediocre growth that goes to the top 10 or top 1%, you know, it's not clear this is a good deal for the rest of the population. So there is a concern about this, particularly in the US. In Europe, the issues are different, but we have rise of, you know, wealth to income ratio and this return of a sort of patrimonial capitalism that's something that plays a big role in the book, is particularly strong, you know, in Britain, in France, in Spain, in Italy, you know, across Europe and also in Japan. And I think this is something that people can feel certainly in real estate prices in this country and in France. But more generally, you know, you can see a return of the role of inherited wealth that you know, was not as important for the post-war generation and for the baby boom cohort. So I guess there are lots of reasons why people, you know, are concerned, more concerned about this issue today. But again, you know, the main purpose of the book is to provide a lot of historical evidence so that, you know, people can write their own conclusions.
Now, I think I'll turn to you first, Richard Wilkinson, because I see a parallel here. You wrote your book, your best-selling book, The Spirit Level, about the social effects of inequality after having written a number of other books before, which it's fair to say didn't get any real media interest at all. And Thomas Piketty likewise has been working quietly and diligently away on data about inequality for about 20 years. And this one, at this moment, has taken off. Do you have any thoughts about why that is? Why the interest now? This rise in inequality you all talk about has been going on for years.
Well, I think that the success of both books, the popularity is an expression of growing worries about inequality since the financial crash of 2008. And there has initially been a trickle of concern about it, but now it's overwhelming concern and I think considerable anger at the extent of the bonus culture, tax avoidance and so on, while other people's incomes are being held down. I think the success of Piketty's book is a really important indication of that growing concern and serious interest in how to solve it.
Polly, what do you make of it? Does it tell you things you didn't know? You didn't like inequality before, and I imagine you don't like it now, but does it tell you something new?
Well, it gives a huge amount of documentary evidence and history, and I like the way he draws back on history and indeed on novels. Often, you know, the work of Jane Austen has often been used, and indeed Balzac, as as good evidence for how people saw money and how people related to money. I mean, Austen's books are entirely about marriage and money. And so I think it has a richness and a depth. I also think that each new wave of these books, whether it's Ha Jun Chang, whether it's, you know, Will Hutton, it catches somebody's imagination somewhere who hasn't thought about these things before. I think the point is that anybody, however right-wing they are, however conservative, if they're confronted with facts that show an ever-rising trajectory into the eternal future of things getting more and more unequal, that alarms people. It's a waste of time having an argument about how equal should we be. Just let's start with, well, suppose we try and hold it where it is now. Wouldn't that be a good idea? You can build a majority on that.
What do you think, Andrew?
I don't think that inequality is an issue in itself at all. So I think that there are genuine issues. And in fact, I think the discussion of inequality distracts from them. So I think that poverty is an issue. I think that there is an issue of unearned income worth debating. And I think that there are issues about market failure and regulatory failure in the banking sector, leading to some of the salaries and so on. So I think that those are all genuine issues. I don't think that once you take those away, there's any residual inequality question. Basically, all that's left once you take those other issues away is, do we object if J.K. Rowling and Cristiano Ronaldo and Simon Cowell have a lot of money? That's, and actually, I think almost no one does. So almost no one really objects to inequality in itself when it comes down to it.
But Richard, I think you do, don't you?
Yes, I do. And I think it's not simply about poverty or unearned income. I thought it was interesting the other day that the Barclays bonuses, they'd put aside, I think, £2.4 billion for bonus payments and only £1 billion for the unearned income of their shareholders. So a great deal of the increase in inequality is income from employment. The differences in pay within companies between CEOs and average production workers, that used to be sort of a difference of sort of 30 or 40 fold around 1980, is now sort of 300 or 400 fold. The CEO is getting that much more than the ordinary production workers. So it's not simply unearned income, and it does absolutely enormous damage to societies. There are endless academic papers using good data for many different countries, showing the decrease in social cohesion, the relationships with violence, with teenage births, with health. There must be close to 200 papers looking at the relationship between income inequality in different countries around the world and the effects on health. And Michael Marmot himself, in his reports to the UK government and to WHO on health inequalities, emphasizes the importance of income differences. In most UK towns, between the richest and poorest areas, you get 5 or 10 year differences in life expectancy.
Andrew, it's quite hard not to care about that, isn't it? Without sounding very callous indeed.
Sorry, what one's caring about there is that some people who are poorer live less long. So that's a thing to care about. The fact that some other people live longer isn't a thing to care about. And the idea that somehow it's because Bill Gates has some billions of pounds, that means that lots of people die earlier. You know, it's just silly.
But can I just, because one thing I find interesting about Piketty, and I think one reason he's striking a chord is, unlike an economist who is trained in the Anglo-Saxon world, who'd be saying, oh, like, this pay's gone up at the top end, let's spot the market failure, let's try and work out exactly what's gone wrong with the rules of the market. I mean, he just sort of comes in and says, well, obviously these people are being paid 10 times more than they were a generation ago, obviously performance isn't 10 times better, so something's gone wrong. It's not like they're generating more money, there's money that could be sitting with someone else. That's the sort of tone of it. It's a more intellectually swaggering and confident performance, and I think that might be why it's catching on.
Well, but it might be. I mean, there are all kinds of things. I'm not necessarily denying. There are all kinds of things to say about the rise of pay inequality. I mean, his main point isn't really about income inequality. It's about wealth inequality. But there are things to say about pay inequality in a globalized environment. I mean, the main way in which inequality arises is that people add value. And when value is added, that value is not shared equally. It's very rare in developed economies for inequality to arise from somebody taking something from someone else. That happens, of course, in many less developed economies. Doesn't really happen very much in our economy.
Rent-seeking CEOs are taking. They're taking from their shareholders. They're taking from their customers. People who are taking walloping great bonuses and walloping great sums at the top, those are rent-seekers, people who take it because they can. And it is other people's wealth. They're just managers. They're not entrepreneurs.
What is there, though? I mean, there, if insofar as you were able to identify some specific market failure associated with that, some way in which the owners of the companies had not been able to adequately discipline,
which shareholders can't, because often they only own the shares for a few weeks.
Well, I don't agree that follows, but it's at least an arguable point that the people end up with lots of money is a separate question from that. The fact that they have lots of money indicates another sort of failure. So very often inequality is criticized because people think of it as a symptom of something else. The question, though, is to whether inequality in itself is a failing. There are some issues here which I think are very important and worth discussing. For example, the question of whether it matters if returns on capital are systematically higher than the growth rates of economy, I think is a very interesting one, particularly in the context in which income is unearned. Now, what does it mean by unearned? I don't mean by unearned income that one simply takes money that one has from one's property. That's not a matter of investment income, because most investment involves work of some sort. What you do is that you take a risk, you analyze what the right risk return is, you analyze the companies that you want to invest in and the ones that you don't, or you hire somebody to do that. And so the return then is a consequence of the work done.
But look, the effects of inequality are regardless of how those inequalities arise. It doesn't matter the issues that are being talked about. As Stiglitz and the International Monetary Fund have shown, even when you just consider the economic effects of inequality, regardless of how the inequality occurs, they're bad for economic performance, and create more booms and slumps. And when Andrew says that it's silly to think that doing anything about top incomes would help, that's a failure to understand the effects of inequality. To understand what inequality does to a society, you have to think more about monkey dominance hierarchies than, for instance, about Marx. It's to do with feelings of superiority and inferiority. And those are extremely damaging in a society, and we have inherited sensitivities to that. The reason why violence goes up, homicide goes up in more unequal countries, is because people feel, because violence is triggered by disrespect, people feeling looked down on, treated as inferior.
Yes, we call that envy, and it's not contentious
it's
that
not,
envy
it's
is a bad
shame,
thing.
It's unhappiness, it's a feeling of failure,
it's
a feeling of being treated as inferior. It's not envy.
But obviously there's a different political perspective about what you call that emotion, but even if you want to call it envy, Andrew, surely it could be an unhealthy frame of mind that could have unhealthy consequences.
Look, if you said that women should keep their eyes covered all of the time because they might create lustful feelings in men, today people would think that was preposterous. But somehow, if people feel bad because they envy other people, it's the person that's envied that's supposed to be the problem, not the envier. What we need to do is to tell people that envy's bad.
Oh, no, your station in life. Yes, you mean if you're on a 0 hours contract, a couple of hours a week, desperate, can't feed your family, having to go to food banks, you're suffering envy.
You should aspire.
That the government is telling you, well, they do aspire, but how can you aspire if they won't give you any extra hours' work? The idea that it's envy is grotesque. This government goes out of its way to make sure that people at the bottom feel the lowest possible self-esteem. They are scroungers. Listen to Ian Duncan Smith's language. Listen to George Osborne and the blinds coming down. People are made to feel lousy, rotten, even when they're very ill and close to death, because they're on benefits, and these days to be on a sickness benefit is to be treated with contempt. That's not envy.
And the effects of that, being treated with contempt and being at the bottom, being unemployed, is to have an enormous increase in depression, which is really disabling in many cases. So you lose any sense of your ability to do anything about your situation. It's extraordinarily damaging, and it's awful to call it envy.
Do you accept, Andrew, that coming out of a kind of recession, which is, we had this long period where things got more unequal, and then we had a recession where everyone got poorer, but of course for people at the bottom that meant they're not just getting relatively poorer, they're getting absolutely poorer, and having not had much to smile about over the last 30 years, the situation's desperate for a lot of people in Britain, isn't it?
It is. And I want to come back to my point that I was trying to make before, because I think it's very important to the attitude to these things. What has happened is if you have a society in which the state uses its power to keep those with wealth wealthy when things go bad, for example, by bailing out the banks, then what that does is it creates a systematic inequity in the system. What it means is that those with capital can then generate high returns, higher than the growth rate of the economy, according to Piketty, without doing any work at all, because they take no risk. That is improper. So the classical theory of property, which most right-wingers would buy, is that of Locke. Property finds its legitimacy by being the combination of work and the common treasury, that's natural resources of various sorts. If, by contrast, somebody who is rich simply becomes wealthier all the time by doing nothing at all, that's improper. Anybody would think that that was improper. And one of the things that's happened in recent years is that because the rich were kept rich at the time of the financial crisis by the banks being bailed out, that has created a general sense that the system is unfair and doesn't work properly. And they're right to think that. What we need to do is to move more towards a society, which we haven't got yet, in which the wealthy are not able to use their political influence to secure the support of the state in keeping them rich when things go bad.
Would you support high inheritance tax?
Absolutely not.
Oh. How are you going to take the wealth away from the rich?
I don't want to take the wealth away from the rich.
Listen, as we are now, those of us who live in London, our houses are earning more than we are when we go out to work. This is insane. We are accumulating wealth which we haven't earned and ought to be taxed and isn't taxed. That's crazy. And then when we die, you're saying, well, you shouldn't even have it taxed for your heirs, so that you can go on accumulating wealth for a small number of people which others don't have.
There's nothing improper about people passing on their property any more than there is about passing on their beauty or passing on whatever, their wisdom to their children. The thing about the problem that arises is when the state intervenes to stop the wealthy becoming poorer,
Andrew,
when there would be circumstances.
Do you think it's right, Andrew, that the richest 100 people in the country own as much as the poorest 30%, or the richest 5 families own as much as the poorest 20% of the population?
I think it would be better if each of those poorest 20% owned as much as each of those 100 people. Obviously, it's better if the poorer were wealthier.
But you don't think anything should be done about that inequality?
There's nothing improper about some people being rich, no.
Improper about poorer areas of the country having 10, 12, 15 years shorter life expectancy than the richer areas?
I think it's... I don't think it would be better, for example, if you took the rich areas and gave them shorter life expectancies. No, I don't think it would be better if everybody was equally in a bad situation.
The data suggests that if you have more equal incomes in a society, that the life expectancy of the whole society tends to be higher.
Well, As I said, I don't accept that that's really what they show at all. But because I think that what you're really talking about, you're disguising discussions about poverty and about how we fund the mechanisms by which we would fund taxes that assist the poor and things like that.
You're thinking in terms of absolute income and absolute material standards, as if it's simply what our housing and air pollution do to our health. But most of these health influences and influences on many other social problems, like violence and obesity and so on, are psychosocial influences, which come from those feelings of inferiority. Yeah. It's the social implications.
Yes, I don't deny that.
It's the social position that matters.
Although I may dispute some of the details of exactly how you calculate these things, I wouldn't dispute the principle that envy can produce bad consequences, that envy exists and it produces bad social consequences.
I thought you gave up the idea of envy earlier when Polly and I were telling you what was wrong with that.
No, I haven't given that up at all.
You really think that clinical depression in unemployed people and poor people?
I think
envy,
that's because of poverty. I think if unemployed people are depressed, it's poverty. I think that suppose that everybody in the world was had all of their needs attended to by robot slaves, and then we add one person who, in addition to having all of that, also has the planet Pluto. I don't think that that's a bad thing. Somebody has something extra. The fact that somebody's wealthier than other people is not a bad thing.
Do you really think it's okay for us to get more and more unequal so that the top and the bottom get further and the middle gets stretched, the whole fabric of society rips? Are you quite happy that the trajectory we're on? Let's say, okay, you're happy with society as it is. Are you happy for it to be 10 times, 20 times more unequal so people really live in totally different realms?
Well, first of all, I'm very sceptical that a properly functioning society would ultimately do that.
But what's happening. It's what's happened for the last 30 years, and all of the trajectories are that it's accelerating.
Producing lower social mobility as well.
I would like to see much higher opportunity for people to move between things. Well, I don't agree with that at all. I think that you do see that, you know, the J.K. Rowlings do become the billionaires today.
Occasional anecdote of somebody, you know, an extraordinary writer or footballer, yes, but across the statistics, you can't possibly deny all of the evidence.
It's absolutely the case that there's less social mobility now than there was in the past, and it's an interesting question. I think that social mobility is a genuine question. I don't accept that social mobility is the same question as inequality. Coming to the point...
Well,
I also don't think...
Andrew, on the social mobility thing, we, in our Spirit Level book, first showed that more unequal countries had lower social mobility. Since then, Alan Krueger, President Obama's, the chair of his Economic Advisory Committee, has shown exactly the same relationship on quite independent data. And you can now see the same pattern in data for most American cities. The more unequal ones have lower social mobility.
It wouldn't surprise me if there were a correlation.
Well established.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if there were a correlation between those two things. But what you're doing is that you're assuming that the causality runs from the inequality to the low social mobility.
Yes.
I would say it runs the other way around.
Ways of passing on their advantages.
Well, I would say that it runs as much the other way around.
As we know, we've got a cabinet of made up of people whose parents could afford for them to go to one school.
Let me answer Polly's earlier point, because I think it's quite important to bear in mind that although we talk about inequality, what we're talking about is wealth and income and things of that sort. But in fact, by many other kinds of measures, what's happened is that the lot of most of us in society have become enormously greater over the past 100, 150 years. We have much better health outcomes. We live much longer than we did in the past. We're enormously higher educated. Almost everybody is. We have much higher literacy. We work much fewer hours.
Yes, of course,
most people
true.
Do
we're not
in the past.
Living the same as we did 150 years ago. We agree. There was a time in which we became more and more equal up until the late 70s. Since then, it's shot off in the other direction all over the world, not just here, across Europe, across America, Japan, and it's going to get much worse, and all of the evidence, there is no economic evidence to show that it's not.
Can we just bring in Richard a second, because we've got to wrap this up in a moment. But Richard, since your book came out, roughly speaking, you've been involved with the Equality Trust trying to campaign on just how you can turn some of these themes into winning political messages, winning campaigns. Do you think it's cutting through? I mean, we're hearing the intellectual argument here again, but do you see any hope of it being picked up by mainstream politics, Richard?
Well, Well, judging by the invitations we get from social democratic parties in Europe, from a huge range of organizations, religious groups, service providers, businesses, and so on, there's enormous concern over these problems, and it is getting picked up. And what we have to do, I think, I regard the bonus culture as an indication of the lack of any constraint at the top, a lack of any democratic constraint, and we must build that in. We must do what many European countries have done, have employee representatives on company boards and give bigger incentives to the growth of cooperatives and employee-owned companies, which have not only smaller income differences, but the data suggests they have better economic performance as well.
Okay, now I can say of this argument even more decisively than the most of them. This one really is going to run and run. There's lots more on inequality on theguardian.com/politics. But before we go, a story that has threatened to destabilise the peace process in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams has been arrested in connection with the notorious Troubles murder of Jean McConville in 1972. Our Ireland correspondent Henry McDonald joins me now. First of all, Gerry Adams had been talking for some time in the context of this murder about how he was willing to talk to the police if asked, but then it seems that he's not only been speaking to them but has been arrested and detained.
He was detained overnight in the serious crime suite PSNI have in Antrim Town, Northern Ireland. So he's still in, and I don't think this was of his timing, because it's lousy timing from his viewpoint, because it's in the middle of an election campaign. What I think has happened is he's been told he would be arrested and has obviously volunteered to go into the police station to be questioned, but not of his timing, not at the right time, so to speak.
And what's the immediate effect? As you say, we're in the middle of the European election campaign. Do you think this would have a big effect on Sinn Féin's standing by stirring up some rather dreadful old memories?
I think it'll have more of an impact, possibly, potentially, in the Irish Republic. Sinn Féin has been at pains to kind of detoxify its brand in the Republic, to reach out to more middle-class voters in the Irish Republic and get away from its long association with Northern Ireland and the Troubles and the IRA and all that. This arrest puts that whole history of the party and key figures in the party and their alleged role in the IRA back into sharp public focus, and I have no doubt that their political opponents will point that out. So, if you think about it, I mean, Martin McGuinness dining with the Queen during the Irish presidential visit to Britain was an attempt to detoxify the brand. This reintroduces the whiff of cordite, if you like, around the party and its past by refocusing on the Jean McConville murder. The point really that needs to be zeroed in on here is the emotive nature of the murder, grabbing a widowed 37-year-old woman, a mother of 10, in front of all her children, screaming and crying and dragging her out of a flat, taking her across the border, shooting her in the back of the head and then burying her body, and the body not being recovered until 2003, and indeed not even admitting until 1999 that the IRA had actually killed the woman. It's almost like the cover-up is almost as bad as the crime. This is almost like, the spectre that keeps coming back to haunt the peace process, this particular ghost of this victim, doesn't seem to go away.
I mean, will there be people saying within Sinn Féin, which is now, big party, a party of government, that it's time for some of the old stages to leave the scene, just so that it continue to operate as a party concerned with the more everyday type of issues?
Yes, well, there are a couple of things to say. Firstly, it has to be stressed, of course, Mr. Adams denies any involvement or knowledge in Jean McConville's abduction and murder, right? Secondly, up until now, the Sinn Féin has been a party that's been faithful and loyal. It's rank and file to Adams and McGuinness. They would see them as delivering the party the votes and, getting away from the association with armed violence to constitutional politics. But there may be voices, they're muted at the moment, within that party saying, well, maybe it's time for a new leader, a slew of leaders, maybe from the people who are based in Dublin rather than Belfast. Maybe that's the road to go down to further kind of change the brand image. The problem would be, for example, if even if there's no criminal prosecution, I've written this in the paper, and the McConville family have told me this directly overnight, that even if the police do not secure any criminal prosecutions based on testimonies of ex-IRA members who are dead, who are saying Gerry Adams was allegedly involved, there may be a civil action taken by the family in this case, modelled on the action taken by the families of the Yuma bomb atrocity against Mr. Adams over the Jean McConville murder. Now, difficult to see a party in government with a leader who's facing a civil action over a murder case that could have major ramifications.
Henry McDonald there. Well, that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Andrew Lillico, to Polly Toynbee, and to Richard Wilkinson. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.